Hello and welcome to the Psychomedia podcast. I am Timothy Swan.
And I'm Ben Fell. And together, we're going to discuss the funny side of penises. I mean psychology. That is this week's first Freud joke, because this week's topic is Freud.
Well, sort of. We're not actually going to tell you anything about Freud,
no.
Or his life, or much of his work.
Or anything to do with him, in fact. if you really want that. So, in a very real sense, this week's episode is about anything but Freud. The theme generally is studies which we think, were Freud alive today, he would approve of.
Yes, and some of them are because of his work, but some of them aren't.
Some of them just tentatively relate to things he may or may not have said, some more tentatively than others.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess it depends on how much of kind of anxiety complex they have about, etc.
etc. etc. Anyway, do we have any backfeeding this week?
Can you stop saying that? Not just for Freudian reasons.
No,
have
no, I can't.
Received any like feedback? To... I'm going to send you to Swiss finishing school, all right? Okay, there we go. I'll let
the rain in Spain falls mainly on the penis.
The good news is I don't have anything to ring, so I don't have to do any Freudian things. although now I'm probably going to be trying to think of them, because the trouble is...
It's pretty easy. Just replace noun with penis.
Right. We've set the tone here. This is terrific. This episode is going to be our most consistent episode yet. And thinking of consistent episodes... let's talk about the feedback. We got a nice long bit of feedback, really, from John D. A comment on psychomedia.wordpress.com regarding episode, I'm going to say 20. It's pretty impressive. We made it to 20. This is episode 21, so it's now legal to drink in America.
You mean it's legal to drink this episode in America?
Yes. In
you can
Britain,
find some way of distilling internet into liquid form.
Well, the internet weighs as much as a strawberry.
I imagine it would be something like chocolate rain. Anyway, sorry, carry on.
Yeah, John. Yeah, sorry, John. We're just like interrupting your thing here because. Well, yeah, we were talking on Twitter this week actually about how the influence of other podcasts come on us, and one of them is, you know, Kermode and Mayo, at least on me and a lot of the podcasts I listen to. And interrupting listener mail definitely is a Kermode and Mayo thing.
Definitely. I mean, just interrupting in general seems to be the foundation of that podcast.
Well, yeah, it might just be that, yeah, it's that Mark Kermode is the interrupting goat.
Is it the interrupting goat? I thought it was the. Interrupting. Oh, there were a number of them, weren't they? And none of them work on air.
I think the interrupting goat, you just have to tell him to butt out and that works.
No, one of them does work on air. You might have heard it. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Interrupting cow.
Interrupting.
Moo.
There we go. Hey, are we just going to spend the whole week doing classic jokes?
Pretty much, yeah, actually.
Cool, because it means there'll be some jokes in this episode.
Well, because Freud wrote a book called, like, Psychoanalysis of Jokes or something.
Oh, yes, what does he conclude that jokes are? They're about releasing kind of repressed tension.
It's all about, like, jokes in the unconscious. We really should know this stuff. Like, I hadn't even got his Wikipedia page open before we started the thing. I do now, but, yeah, well, that's unfortunate.
It's too obscene for our eyes. John said that episode 20, unlike this episode, was a really good episode. It was nice to have a cohesive episode with a good dose of psychology that involved both of you. And he admits that he only gives a sort of cursory listen to the Hemi, Demi, Semi, Franken podcasts.
Well, that's understandable.
Well, sometimes. Some of them are more psychological than others, because some of them have, like, psychology in that we just kind of cut out for time, and some of them are just rambling about media. like some of your other listeners, I found the statistics Ben was talking about rather interesting. I have a heavily mathematical background, so I was sort of surprised when he said n greater than three-dimensional spaces with such trepidation, as if there were any other kind, which makes me wonder about the psychology of mathematics. When we mathematicians talk about seeing everything in terms of mathematics, is there some sort of psychological phenomenon here, or is it just an artifact of the way we talk? Is there anything psychologically interesting about doing maths? And have you ever run about If you ever run out of things to talk about, maybe this is an option. There's a cool case study, apparently, of that's summarized as the man whose hand draws mathematical fractals, which does sound cool. And there's a fellow called Dr. Brogaard, which sounds like the most frat boy Dutch man of the time. His current research is on about that. Now, yeah, I think we have a bad experience because of the people who used to do the psychology of mathematics and number at our university. Maybe didn't get us as thrilled as we could be about it, but we'll certainly look into it sometime. Psychology of maths.
That we could, oh God, my mouse has just died. We could totally do an episode on the psychology of maths because it is really cool. And there are plenty of things we could talk about it. I heard that there was a guy at Oxford who is trying to teach people in physics to think in multiple dimensions. I can't remember who was telling me about this. It was someone in psychology that was telling me. But yeah, he's trying to kind of get a bunch of physics students to have the brain power to think in like upwards of four dimensions, because it is not what you would call natural. Which I thought was quite cool.
Yes. I mean, I don't think it's possible, but there's only one way to find out. And that's by breaking a whole load of physicists so they can only see the non-Euclidean Cthuloid horrors that happen when you actually open your brain to that sort of thinking. So, Exactly. Yes, a success story for Psychomedia here. Dean wrote in saying that she got 100% on her psych paper. So thank you, Psychomedia. If you recall last week, we mentioned how we were teaching her more than her teacher.
That's amazing.
Psychomedia, official almost teaching. Like,
that's an N of one correlation equaling causation, but I'm going to take that as a win.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I basically claim credit for everything she does.
I think so should we.
Yes, let's do it. Let's join the club of controlling Dean's life. And then finally, Kiha the Seagull said on Twitter that your received pronunciation tones, Ben, totally hid the fact that you are using Valley Girl linguistic tricks. Apparently in the last episode, I don't quite know. I didn't realize that you were a Valley Girl, but I spent all the time thinking about, have you seen the bonus episode of House? I mean, you're unlikely to have, but there's a bonus episode on
Huddy and the other one,
Cameron. Incidentally, if you listen to
Valley Girls,
if you listen to Tim and Max this week, I spent about half the episode pretending I'm married to Jennifer Morrison, who played Cameron.
I guess that's what I'm not doing this week.
It's not that bad. I totally
that
get distracted.
Remains to be seen.
Literally about 2 seconds later, I get distracted by how much I love Robert Carlyle. Which is interesting, given the topic of this week, you know.
Yes, enough cross-pollination, Timsbury.
Oh, yeah, and Kiha notes that, yeah, plenty of people have made the comparison, including a guy called Robert Anton Wilson, between the chimps being...
That sounds like three people.
Rob, Ant, and Will believe that, the human equivalent of the chimps poop-throwing to show off intelligence is writing a lot of papers.
Ah, that could work. It applies to the same principle of throw enough mud at a wall and eventually some of it will stick.
Yes. If you use a shotgun, you're bound to kill someone.
Yes.
That's my version of that. when's Dexter
anyway,
coming back? That is all the feedback, at least all the feedback that I managed to collate.
Well, that's good. I like the idea of a one on maths. We should totally do that because I've already thought of including the ones that... what was the guy's name? James?
John.
John, close enough. Okay.
John D. That's John Dorian. I was just thinking. Yeah. I've been watching a bit of Scrubs this week. I'm going to pretend that he is.
I'm sorry
JD.
To hear that. Anyway, yes. The one about the case study sounds really cool. And I've thought of at least two other things we could talk about. So, I mean, that's basically a podcast in and of itself.
Cool. So,
So what have you done this week, Tim?
What have I done this week? I'm sure that I did some things, some actual things. No, interestingly, after the disgusting episode, which I recorded on a Tuesday, I got horribly and unpleasantly ill the very next day. So well done, Psychomedia.
How ironic.
Yeah, I know. There's a sense of irony. So that's kind of taken out my ability to do things, apart from, you know, did anyway. So I'd watched some movies, but I can't really remember. Oh, I watched Skellig with Tim Roth. I don't really have anything to say about that apart from it had Tim Roth in, and of course that's my rap name, so I spent the time feeling vaguely kind of just cool, lying there debilitated going, yeah, I'm Master Professor Timmy S. Roth.
Good.
And I watched Cars by Pixar, which I'd never seen, which is, it's a very beautiful looking film, but it isn't really like the Pixar standard.
I'm going to sort of derail that to say that my girlfriend has basically a PTSD reaction to the Pixar movie Robots, which...
That's not a Pixar movie, but I have seen it recently.
The movie Robots.
Why?
As a result of having to show it to people in an EEG study, like, every day for several months, but only ever, like, the first 20 minutes of it.
Wow, that would drive me mad.
It did. So now, yeah, if ever the first 20 minutes of Robots is on, the red mist descends and you kind of have to, yeah, get sort of cool towels and things to calm her down.
Weird.
Yeah, it's crazy. Poor girl.
But yeah, neither of those things were things I planned to talk about.
No?
I wanted to talk about Twin Peaks and Community. TV shows.
Okay, these are at least one of those is definitely good.
Yeah, well, I think I'll start on Twin Peaks. I don't know if I mentioned it because I haven't listened back to a couple of podcasts ago.
You have mentioned it before, but it might get cut.
This is the thing, is that you've got this kind of, I haven't cut as much in recent, I'm lazy at editing these days.
I think
right?
It adds a sense of mystique to every podcast when we refer to things that people don't remember happening.
Well, it messes up the chronology, because often stuff that is cut then later ends up back in if it was even vaguely passably interesting.
You have to embrace these things. Make it intentional. Make it a challenge.
Yeah, there is a true narrative that has been cut up and spread throughout. And if you listen to all the episodes, then you might be able to find the secret of who killed Laura Palmer. Twin Peaks is just a very haunting and beautiful show. It's set on the US-Canadian border. There's a sawmill. There's a small community around it. There's a shocking murder. And Kyle MacLachlan, who you might recognize out of Desperate Housewives, if you're that sort of person.
You are that sort of person.
Or How I Met Your Mother, where he played Jennifer Morrison's husband, like me.
Fair enough.
Oh, no, I'm just going to pretend to be Kyle MacLachlan all day. Diane, this pie is excellent. sorry, I'm going to go completely mad if I do that. But yeah, he's a strange but very intuitive and clever detective who comes to try and solve this shocking murder and discovers that Twin Peaks is the weirdest place on Earth and that everyone is up to something pretty dastardly. And the music is very kind of strange and almost intrusive, but it gets you into a kind of mindset because it's so powerful. And you should definitely get the box set and watch it. Or look out for reruns on the Horror Channel if you have satellite television.
If you like being weirded out by David Lynch.
Yeah, but it's not like a Eraserhead. You know, it's not... I don't feel like it pushes you away. It's the level of weirdness that draws you in, and some of it's so weird that it's funny, and some of it's so weird that it just absolutely intrigues you and you try and figure out the mystery. Huh? So yeah, it's super. You should watch it. Yeah, Community, which I believe you know a bit more about.
Because it's awesome.
Yes, the American version of Spaced is what I think of it as. Episode has a different genre, it's got an ensemble cast, and it's really, really funny and geeky.
I remember thinking that about it when I first saw it, and then I haven't thought that about it for many, many periods of time through which I've been watching it. And now I'm thinking it again, so thank you.
Anyway, it's about to return the coming week. The week in which this episode is released, I believe.
Oh, gosh. Well, what on earth are you doing listening to this episode? Go and watch Community.
Well, no, it hasn't come back yet. It's coming back on the 15th.
Oh, okay.
So it will be before our next episode is out, at least. Anyway, the point is they've released a short animated series to promote its return, which involves Abed, the best character, he suggested in the first episode to have Asperger's, but is a kind of lovable, if maybe slightly stereotyped, character. He receives the master key from the dean so that he can become the deputy dean and help the dean out because of the budget cuts. But of course, he is tempted to abuse his power and compare everything to Lord of the Rings.
Excellent.
And, yeah, it's great. It's great to see them in animation because it's always funny when they're animated. And the series returns on the 15th, and everyone should watch it in America on actual TV if they can, because you've got to save the show, because if you ruin it, because we haven't had the chance to not watch it properly.
Gosh darn it, we'll take the country back.
Yeah, I'm not sure what we'll do apart from airstrikes. I haven't thought much more beyond that.
Airstrikes are really hard. It's very difficult to hold a sign up when you're floating. What was I going to say? The 15th of March is the Ides of March.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So we'll kill your president as well.
Yeah, totally. With daggers. And a Roman.
Et tu, Bene! If I could do impressions, then I would have done that in a Barack Obama voice. So if anyone can do impressions, send someone saying, Et tu, Bene! In an Obama voice, and we'll totally put it in the next show.
Oh, belabored segue from that into what I've been doing this week. What I've been doing this week is playing a whole bunch of Mass Effect 3.
Of course.
The belabored segue being that there's a couple of characters in it who have vaguely Roman-sounding names.
Yeah, you can think of Garrus.
Well, I think a lot of the Turians seem to have that kind of like Roman legionnaire thing with surnames like Victorian and stuff. Anyway, that's massively nerdy. I've been playing a bunch of Mass Effect 3, and I know that it is being gratuitously shafted by EA to get as much like wring as every single cent out of it as possible, but it's really, really good, like really good, like extra good. And so the upshot of this is, as has become traditional, if the quality of this week's podcast isn't up to much, it's BioWare's fault. It usually is. And it definitely is this week, because I was up way later than I meant to be last night, fighting back tears for much of the time, actually, I have to say, because it's that good.
I'm going to be an emotional wreck by the time I buy that and play it, aren't I?
Yeah.
What if my precious shepherd dies, Ben?
The thing that really, really annoys me about it is that I still haven't played Mass Effect 1. And therefore, some of the decisions that I could have made during Mass Effect 1 got automatically made for me at the beginning of Mass Effect 2 when I started. Yeah. But those, because I have played Mass Effect 2 and I am carrying my character over, those decisions are still with me in Mass Effect 3 and actually have quite a major impact.
Oh, really?
Which is annoying. Because
the default is quite a bad option, isn't it?
Yeah, or at least
you don't get
very much subtlety in the decisions you make, and it kind of automatically chooses a bunch of things for you, things which I'm quite unhappy about having got to number 3. So what I'm going to have to do, unfortunately, is go back and start a new character and play all the way through when I've finished. But that's going to mean transitioning from playing Mass Effect 3 to playing Mass Effect 1, which is going to be a painful transition, I think.
It's so slightly similar but slightly different that I do remember when I did that for my Renegade playthrough, it did jar.
Because apart from the fact that the storyline and the writing and the voice acting in 3 are beyond stellar, they're just incredible, which you kind of expect from BioWare, but then again, their last single player game was Dragon Age 2. So it does bear pointing out just how good Mass Effect 3 is. The problem is also that the gameplay and everything is just so slick and so well put together that I'm worried that I'm just going to have to suffer through Mass Effect 1. But it'll give me an excuse to roll FemShep, so that will be interesting.
Yeah, well, you know, I always started off with females, so in my mind, that guy on the front of the Mass Effect box, I don't know who that is. Mm.
Well, my current one is importing. This is like massively nerdy, but anyway, for anyone who doesn't like, you know, niche BioWare, well, not niche BioWare games, but yeah, RPGs.
The very nitty gritty of the process.
The importing my character from 2 to 3. He looked kind of okay. He's kind of like Ginger, obviously, but with a big handlebar moustache in number 2, and that worked quite well. It didn't translate into the Mass Effect 3 face engine.
Yeah.
So I just created a new one from scratch who, they had this wonderful comb over haircut, which reminded me of like RAF fighter pilots. So I've given him that and like the pencil mustache. which actually doesn't look as creepy as you'd think it would. It's still quite creepy, but not as bad as it could have been.
Okay. So while we're thinking about, you know, like face creation and stuff, do you see what I'm doing here?
Yeah, I do see what you're doing there, but I mean, there were a couple of other things that I'd
see,
I didn't
go
really,
for them.
They weren't really interesting.
Well, just let people know that there was a point there where we could have made a good segue and we're going to forsake it.
Well, no, we'll come back to it because that makes it even more belabored.
Okay. I'll set up a time loop now. You go into the stable time loop. I'll stay here. And
can you make a gentle humming noise in the background to denote the fact that I'm in an outside of normal space time?
This is going to sound terrible, I'm sure.
So this week I also found a house that I'm hopefully going to live in next year, which is really nice. It's got everything you'd want from like a student property. It's got two bedrooms, a garden, a living room, people smoking marijuana next door, all mod cons. So that was good. And I also watched a bunch of Arrested Development, which I've never seen before, on recommendation.
Oh, that's good transition into the next thing anyway.
Oh, okay. So well, yeah, it was great. I did not realize it had Portia del Rossi in it, which is amazing. Or whatever her now ridiculously long, like, six-part name is that includes, like, DeGeneres and, like, Jeff and Steve and a bunch of other weirdly incongruous extra names. Which is great because she's awesome. She's also in Better Off Ted and playing almost the same character, which is fine by me. Yeah, it's really good. And like weirdly young Michael Cera doing like incest jokes. It's great. Which also transitions neatly into stuff we're talking about this week.
God. Yeah, I do feel that one's attitude towards Michael Cera is very much determined on whether one has watched Arrested Development, because I used to find him annoying and then I watched Arrested Development and I really like him. Which is, huh. I don't know why. I used to find him really annoying in all the films that he was in, and then I watched Arrested Development, and now I kind of like him. And yet the films are the same. He's still putting in the same performance.
Mm. Yeah, maybe you just sort of forgave him for it more when he was young. And yeah, he was perhaps one of the less annoying characters on that show. I mean,
well, yeah,
obviously
he is the most sympathetic character, probably.
Unless you have particularly strong opinions about incest.
Oh, well, I mean, my favourite character is Job, but he's not sympathetic.
this is true.
Anyway.
Yeah, well, would you like to rock the belaboured segue?
Yeah, well, talking of jokes about incest, let's talk...
And faces!
And yes, talking about making faces, let's look at our first study, which is that merged faces of family members actually appear more attractive, which is a summary which slightly obscures the truth. So I'll actually tell you about it. Now, once upon a time, there was a big fight in the psychological literature. Big surprise, eh? And the fight was about whether humans were naturally incestuous or not. Now, Sigmund Freud took one of the sides in this fight. Can you guess which side he fell down on? Yeah, that's right. If you know a little about Freud, he believed that we, because of society and the like, repressed inbuilt biological desires for our family members. And whereas, by contrast, on the other side of the debate, Westermark, a Finnish sociologist and also a land in Lord of the Rings, I think.
notable for its low levels of incest.
Yeah. No, I was just thinking about if there was any incest in Rohan, but I can't think of it.
Anyway. I was just thinking about all the Hobbit video blogs that I've been watching and how excited I am about that film, but carry on.
Okay, when you said the Hobbit video blogs, I thought you meant video blogs by Hobbits. I was like, what have you been reading? Anyway, Westermark argued that it's not adaptive to be attractive to our family, so we must have a biological mechanism to avoid it. And most subsequent research in the modern day, at least, has backed up Westermark. On account of it being basically sensible, we know that incest taboos are a pretty universal thing, and that inbreeding does lead to bad consequences genetically over the long term. So, clearly having a mechanism to avoid it is helpful. Now, the key bit of evidence actually used to back this up is that children raised together don't feel attraction to one another, regardless of how related they are. And since that finding was found, there's been a lot of stuff that suggests, you know, a kind of computational picture where a module in the brain calculates, based on various factors like time spent together, sharing a room, playing together, whether one is related to a person and therefore too related to safely, as it were, desire them.
And it's like a critical period. which we have never talked about before. Oh, but yeah, like,
yeah, there's a developmental phase perhaps where we work that out. Mm. Because otherwise, you know, spending time together would decrease attraction, which actually it doesn't. And indeed, that's what humans are like. You know, without a computational module to warn us, we're going to be interested in anyone. However, there is this tiny undercurrent of contrary research. For example, another very famous one, study shows that women often marry men that look very similar to their adoptive father. Basically, if you show people a picture of, here's a woman, here's what her dad looks like, pick out of these three who she is married to, and it's just like, well, that guy looks like her adoptive father. Pick, and, you know, in general, that's the trend. Mm. So, Fraley and Marx followed up this line of inquiry that suggests there are some incestuous sort of tendencies, because hey, what's more fun than using public money to prove we're all secretly incestuous? And they did some creepy and freaky but quite effective experiments. Now, they do have some weird justifications for why these processes might be going on. For example, the fact is, people are more attracted to a person who goes to their class 15 times than one who goes to their class 5 times, and from there, spending lots of time with our family means we might be attracted to them. It's like, I think that's a bit of a leap, guys. But they also suggest social sanctions, this is a quotation, against mother-son relations have inspired one of the most frequently used derogatory terms in Western languages, Arango 1989. And later I'll talk about melon farmers, so, you know, the circle will be complete. So yeah, the first experiment they did on their participants, they subliminally flashed a picture of the parent of the opposite sex to a person, or they used the same picture with a participant who wasn't related to them. They kind of paired up participants and controls that way, and then asked participants to rate the attractiveness of a person in the picture that was then shown for longer afterwards. And what they emphasized was that they should rate the sexual attractiveness of the picture they saw. And what happened was, with the unconscious prime of the parent, there was a significant difference, an increase in attractiveness when you were in the condition being shown your opposite sex parent. So that's pretty weird to start with.
Yes.
And, you know, it is kind of one where you wouldn't really want to know that you'd been involved in it yourself. Then they moved on to the face morphing. We talked a bit about face morphing last time. I believe we included in the show notes some face morphs, or a face morph of me and Ben. So anyone who looked at that, well, this is the thing. In theory, composite images in general are supposed to get more highly rated for attractiveness. You have to control when you're face morphing.
Yeah, that one I did of my housemate and Margaret Thatcher, probably not so much then. That was uncanny.
Yeah, literal shuddering.
It was weird. This guy, I against his will, merged his face with that of Margaret Thatcher in a non-mad scientist way. And, like, obviously, at one end it looks completely like him, and the other end it looks completely like Margaret Thatcher. But then, weirdly, somewhere in the middle, Paul McCartney emerged and then disappeared again. It was so creepy.
Well, this is the thing. There's only a finite number of faces. Right? This is an established biological fact. The genes that code for faces give us what? There's about 5,000-ish different faces, which, you know, there's some, obviously, some variation for each people, hair, style, and colour and that. But there is a set number of faces. And clearly, if you morph...
What are you basing this on, Tim? Because this does sound like you're talking out of your arse.
No, I can't remember the source, all right? Citation needed, but I read about it somewhere, and my brain's remembered the detail rather than the provenance.
Better than citation needed.
anyway, so yeah, the face morphing.
No, I was going to say a thing.
Okay.
About face morphing. Oh, yeah. When you look at our face merge, is that face merge a perfect 50-50?
No, it isn't.
Why not?
I can't remember why not. Oh, wait. It's because it just looks like you in the 50-50. It doesn't have, like, there's no sign face that I'm there at all. And that's weird.
I always look at that and I'm like, man, that looks so much like Tim. And now I know why.
Because I think it is more like I can't remember what it is. It's not 50-50, because the 50-50 one doesn't look like a face morph. It just looks like you on a slightly bad day.
Thanks.
Apparently that's what I bring to the table. So yes.
Dishevelment.
Yeah. Anyway, so they got into the face morphing business and they tested... That sounds quite different to what it is, isn't it? Kind of science fiction-y.
Yeah, well, similarly with the merging the face of a friend with that of Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah, that's more dystopian than anything else, isn't it? And they showed participants a set of faces that contained up to a 45% morph for two reasons. One, 45% morph is about the parent-sibling level of similarity, mm-hmm. and also it's the level below which the people don't notice that they've been morphed. If you put it from 50% kind of upwards, they're like, wait, that guy looks familiar.
Mummy?
yeah. Now, they didn't morph in relatives. They morphed in the person's own face for no adequately explored reason, except that I suppose they are. It's going to be more confusing to have a morph of a slightly older person if you're using parents, and you wouldn't necessarily be consistently able to get siblings. Mm. So, and yeah, it is, like, the face you create is a prospective sibling. It's going to be someone with the genes similar enough that it would be wrong to mate with them.
Well, yeah,
it would be a risky long-term strategy. Now, we know...
That's such a good pickup line.
Yeah, we should try some of this stuff, you know, in the kind of ecologically valid real world.
Oh, you wait till my study, man. You wait.
You look like you could have up to 45% of my face morphed into your own, which is my level of attraction. We know that...
I'd like to morph my face with yours.
Well, yeah, that is basically saying...
Up to 45%. But no more.
Because then it would be weird. But yeah, we know for me, for example, that if I had a 45% morph of my face with someone else's face, it doesn't really matter what the other face is going to look like. It's going to spike attraction. But what about the participants? Well, they showed increased attraction. Strangely, they even showed increased attraction in that condition to the 0% face. So they did a quick post hoc pilot, if that's a thing you can do. And they found that this was probably because they were similar to the morphed faces that they had found attractive for the incestuous reasons. And so it was basically like, oh, I'm attracted to that person because they are similar to me and the incest kind of drive is there. And then I'm attracted to that person because they're similar to that other person. It's like that person who I like has a kind of attractive other sister. Creepiest study of all time.
That is pretty creepy. That is pretty creepy.
So then they repeated the experiment to add this kind of conscious taboo and told people that their face had been morphed in. So it's the same pictures, the same sort of pictures, but varying levels of awareness. A control where they don't know about it and the experimental group where they do know that they're morphed in. And surprise, surprise, the participants who knew the stimuli were in a way incestuous showed less attraction. So they suggest this is evidence for the Freudian position that this is a conscious repression rather than a non-conscious calculation using the cues. Now, there might be some questions about the artificiality of the test because it doesn't give any of the evidence that we'd normally use to have our non-conscious avoidance, but it does suggest that we have this attraction to similarity that has been established previously. You know, opposites don't tend to attract similar,
So I have got this right. They never at any point actually merged actual family member faces.
No, they
were just using
family members, and then they merged with pupils' own faces. They never merged family members.
Okay.
I mean, I imagine they would predict that merging with family members would have a similar effect to the same members.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's a thing for future research, I guess.
Yeah, I was wondering about narcissism, basically.
Yeah.
And whether kind of having... a sense of whether you yourself are attractive and kind of a certain degree of narcissistic self-attraction might come into this. But it's kind of a bit of a messy question, and there are better criticisms to this study.
Yeah. Well,
I put in the Dropbox folder, but I'm not sure if you read.
Oh, no. I didn't. What I would like to say is that what they suggested from this is that this is part of a process that is trying to keep outbreeding and inbreeding down. That what we're looking for is similarity but not incest. And so our parents form part of an ideal for pair bonding. Without going as far as Freud did, they very clearly say, we think the process is an evolutionary psychology one. We don't think it's psychodynamic. And, you know, this process of looking for similarity has been found in quails. Delicious, delicious quails are attracted in general to kind of first cousin or second cousin separation, because they're similar but not too similar.
Huh.
And indeed, based on this, they try and explain the Oedipus myth. From this point of view, one reason Oedipus longed for and eventually married his mother in the myth of Oedipus Rex is because she was related to him. His desire was possible, however, only because he was unaware of his true relationship to her. Which is quite a good way of fitting it in with the whole Freud's example of the Oedipal complex.
It is rather. When I was kind of I was looking for the PDF of this article so that Tim could do his research, I also came across another paper by Lieberman, Fesler, and Smith, called "The Relationship Between Familial Resemblance and Sexual Attraction: An Update on Westermarck, Freud, and the Incest Taboo," which kind of points out a number of logical and methodological flaws, or at least oversights, in the what's his name?
Fraley and Marx,
yeah, paper. Basically, there, Fraley and Marx will kind of point, sort of going in contravention to the Westermarck theory,
yes,
as you pointed out. The Lieberman article, well, I won't go into it into any detail because it doesn't have any cool like Freudian stuff in it. Basically, is arguing that you, it is perfectly possible to interpret their results using Westermarck's hypothesis. And it's to do with things about Fraley and Marx kind of misconstruing evolutionary kind of mating theory and stuff like this. And kind of some dodgy stuff about subliminal priming and norms and things.
Okay.
So yeah, I mean, it's a cool study. Whether it actually at a theoretical level kind of does undermine this idea that we are not naturally predisposed to incest, is debatable.
Yeah, study without, you know, a lot of more control, I think, can't break down, you know.
No.
But clearly, there is a process going on, and we know that similarity is a key thing in attraction.
Yes.
So you'd think that would be what's driving this. I would guess. I don't know. I'm not an evolutionary biologist, but that is my instinct.
I'm not an evolutionary biologist, but some of my best friends are evolutionary biologists.
It's not not true for me.
Likewise.
You know, my ancestors in the primal environment, you know, they found that evolutionary biologists just didn't help them survive out there. So I've got that kind of hangover in the modern day of that behavior of avoiding evolutionary biologists. If you're into evolutionary behavioral stuff, that's quite a good joke, if I do say so myself. But then, you know, I just was predisposed in the
emergent
kind of behavioral environment. I'm going to keep doing this until you talk about your thing, Ben.
And to get back to primal soup and the single-celled organism, which is self-aggrandizing and tells its jokes ad nauseum until it gets eaten by a larger one.
Wait, a larger single-celled or just a larger Tim single-celled?
A larger anything. Just anything.
I wish I could divide by meiosis. Not meiosis, mitosis. Damn. I'm going to make all of the biologists who listen to this laugh at me. And not in the right way that is supposed to be the way this podcast works.
It looks pretty right from where I'm sitting.
Yeah? Why don't you talk about some psychology and then I'll laugh at you?
Okay, I'll talk about some psychology which has porn and willies in it. Hooray!
Hooray!
It's this study that we mentioned a couple of weeks ago by Adams, Wright, and Lure, 1996, called "Is Homophobia Associated with Homosexual Arousal?" It's a brilliant study, but we only briefly touched on it last week, or the week before, whenever it was we did it. So I thought it definitely warrants going into a bit more detail. So, in summary, this is a study where homophobic men show an increase in penile erection when presented with gay porn. Lol.
Is that literally the title?
Yes.
You know, the way the language is going to change, that lol is going to enter into acceptable language use, 50 years from now there will be, I'm just thinking, yeah, you know, the Journal of Applied Lulls.
Doing it for the lulls. That's what happened. So I figure we might as well go through this systematically. So we start off with the theory and the background. It's pretty straightforward. Some people think that homophobia may represent a fear of being unable to repress one's own homosexual urges despite self-identifying as heterosexual. There's definitely seems to be like an anxiety component to full-on homophobia, which may be due to this kind of repressed homosexual urges. It could be due to sort of other things, but that's probably this is the theory that they're hoping to test in this paper. As for the methods, they got a bunch of male undergraduate participants who'd been screened with the Kinsey Heterosexual Homosexual Rating Scale.
Oh, yeah.
And the Hudson and Ricketts Index of Homophobia. And they selected participants who had reported being exclusively heterosexual on the Kinsey scale. And then they split them into groups of homophobic and non-homophobic. The homophobes had a mean homophobia score of 80.4, which is a first-class degree in homophobia from Oxford. or a starred first if you're at Cambridge. Apparently... It turns out, so in Oxford, you basically just get a first, and many, if you get above 70%, and it's pretty much the same lot universities. At Cambridge, if you get, I think it's above 80, you get a starred first, and maybe if you get above 90, it's like a double starred first or something. I didn't think that there was anything like that at Oxford, but according to Wikipedia, you can get a congratulatory first.
But don't you have to be the best in your year or something for that?
Oh, is that what it is? I didn't know.
And I always wondered... who got it in our year, because we knew most of the people just about who did psychology, and I want to know who was the best, and I want to know how much better than me they were.
Are you sure you don't want to be the very best, like no one ever was?
We're not doing Pokemon Freud, because who knows where that will go.
Oh dear.
Freudmon, I choose you. I know that calling someone Freudmon is more like Digimon. I know.
Well, you need to get the balls flying around.
See, this is what was going to happen.
I missed the chime.
Weird as it is to suggest, go back to the homosexual pornography.
Yes. Get the hints to the homosexual pornography. So, yes, that was how they selected their participants, based on first-class honours in homophobia. Then they measured they presented them with various... 4-minute clips of pornography. Pornography was either a heterosexual, homosexual male, or homosexual female. The reason they included the homosexual female is because it's been found A, to induce high levels of arousal in heterosexual males, and B, because it distinguishes better between heterosexual and homosexual males, because heterosexual males feel arousal towards it, homosexual males don't, compared to heterosexual porn. Yeah, things you never knew about porn.
I was going to say something like speak for yourself, but it's not dead. Yeah. Carry on. As you were. It's the science of it I'm interested in. I only read it for the articles. Carry on.
Excellent.
Which is weird, because with the internet now, you don't have that the excuse anymore. That was the thing about Playboy. They employed journalists as well. As far as I'm aware, there isn't an equivalent of good journalism, but also, like, you know, explicitly sexual stuff on the internet.
You've never read Nature Neuroscience. I don't... That's based on absolutely nothing. Like,
yeah, you're just, like, slandering them.
If I knew more journals, then I would totally pick one to that was apropos, but I really don't, so I'm just...
My first thought was the Huffington Post for the journalism.
That sounds like it should be a dirty magazine, but I'm not sure if it is.
No, I'm pretty confident that it isn't.
Okay.
Sorry, I keep distracting you.
That's fine. It's unacceptable. So, as we'd done the selection in the porn, they had their arousal measured using a mercury in rubber circumferential strain gauge, which was something that should have been included in the outro to that episode we did ages ago about Phineas Gage. For gauging gauging the gauge of your tamping iron.
Oh, I know I was thinking it, but why?
Gosh, just that. Never mind. No, that's too involved and dirty. Anyway, so a mercury in rubber circumferential strain gauge, which also should be a post-rock band name. or as I think it's XKCD was saying, mercury and rubber circumferential strain gauge .tumblr.com.
Yeah, or F yeah. I can't remember exactly what to say. Mercury strain gauge penile plethysmograph.
Mercury in rubber circumferential strain gauge. Attached to a plethysmograph, a penile. So altogether, this produces the wonderfully named penile plethysmograph. And the reason that they use this, incidentally, that means that it's a little bit of it's basically a flexible thermometer attached to
pressure monitor
thermograph thing, which measures penile circumference. Apparently, penile circumference is a good measure because it only registers two possible states, either being sexually aroused or being asleep. And I was trying to think of a situation in which that ambiguity could be problematic, which is surprisingly hard to do. The only thing I could come up with was the following chat-up line. Is that an alpha band EEG signal in your pocket, or are you just pleased to see me? Which is funny because, and everyone knows things are funnier if you have to explain them, because
that's the basis of my comedy career.
Nocturnal penile tumescence, or NPT, occurs primarily during REM sleep, which is characterized by alpha rhythm activity. Unfortunately, for this...
Alpha rhythm activity sounds like the sort of thing that should be in a chat-up line.
It does. And thus it is. Unfortunately, for the chat-up line to work, you would have had to have connected your target to both a penile plethysmograph and an electroencephalogram, and the only situation where that's likely to occur is in a psychological study of sleep and sexual arousal, in which case chat-up lines are probably likely to get you in trouble with ethics.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, the penile plethysmograph is a bit troublesome for me because I'm heterosexual. I mean, where what do I do with it when I'm trying to chat?
Well, yes, exactly. No, it's of no use for us. I don't think there's a female equivalent.
Let's not go into that. There are equivalent measures that measure similar variables, I think, in terms of the psychological side. Let's find out what actually happened in the study.
Am I inducing anxiety? Because incidentally...
I'm just remembering the sort of people who listen to this show.
Right. Okay, moving on. The results are wonderful and brilliant. All participants showed an increase. Well, this part isn't, but it's just kind of expected. All participants showed increased physical and self-rated arousal to the heterosexual and the female homosexual stimuli, which incidentally, the content of which is gone into in quite some detail in the paper. But I didn't think that really needed delving into. If you want that, then once again, this week, references should be in the show notes. only the homophobic males showed physical arousal to the male homosexual stimuli, despite low subjective ratings of arousal, extremely low subjective ratings of arousal. Thus, repression and Freud being happy in his grave. The conclusions were kind of... The obvious conclusion is this one of sort of repressed homosexual urges and anxiety. The authors did admit that... a potential confound could be due to the fact that apparently anxiety can cause what's the word? Well, I didn't want to say anxiety can cause an erection because that's not exactly right, but it can cause physical arousal of that nature.
Oh yeah, I mean, I suppose if that kind of the sympathetic nervous system or something is already het up.
Hmm.
Then it's going to be more responsive to stimuli that otherwise wouldn't kind of...
Exactly. So there is this study by Barlow, which I was like, oh, right, they're referencing someone about this whole anxiety-causing erections thing. That seems a little unbelievable, but I'll go and have a look. What they actually mean is exactly as you say, that in anxiety-inducing situations, physical arousal is kind of augmented. Specifically, though, I wanted to look at this study by Barlow, and it turns out that it's an absolute doozy, but kind of distressing as well. So the
psychology.
The abstract runs as follows. 12 male subjects, a small sample size, not very good, were trained to... They didn't say that. I did. Who were trained to expect tolerance-level electric shocks viewed in erotic film under three different counterbalance conditions. In one condition, subjects viewed the erotic film in conjunction with a signal light indicating threat of shock. A second light indicated threat of shock if subjects did not achieve an erection of a certain size.
What?
I know! That's amazing! A third light indicated no shock. Both anxiety-inducing threat and both anxiety-inducing shock threat conditions increased penile response over and above the no shock threat condition. Further, shock threat contingent on the size of erection produced more arousal than non-contingent shock threat. Basically, there is more arousal if there is a threat of being shocked while you're watching porn, and that the most arousal is if that shock is dependent on you not getting an erection. Or rather, if you don't get an erection, you get shocked.
You can't see my face right now, but my face is stunned.
Thus, this week's Psychomedia top tip.
Hooray!
Which in itself is slightly... if your male partner is underperforming in the bedroom, threaten him with electrocution.
It's literally true.
It is. There is no ambiguity about that. That is gospel truth.
I wouldn't necessarily use that phrase.
Never was...
It's horrifying truth.
Postscripts to this amazing study. This was published in the Journal of Abnormal Psychology, which is apt, but it should definitely be renamed the Journal of Cruel and Unusual Psychology. Yes. Wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. Well done, Barlow.
Yeah, I was going to make a joke about how Coronation Street has raised its intellectual game, but I'm not sure it has done that. I think it's not going to be allowed to show a booby shown before the watershed.
Anyway, yeah, so that's my study. Those are my studies. I thought they were quite good, really.
Yeah, I'm impressed. If by impressed, you mean terrified. I'm glad, but not terrified at the threat of electric shock. I'm avoiding getting scared in, you know, a kind of physiological way.
We occasionally complained about the fact that Oxford doesn't study sexual psychology because we thought it would be really interesting. I am now really glad that Oxford doesn't study sexual psychology.
Okay, right. One last note on sexual psychology, and then I'll talk about something that's totally asexual. I may be lying. Anyway, yeah, there's studies about, you know, how potentially the idea of a fetish, a sexual fetish, that is, if we're avoiding the Marxist term, can come just simply through association. So just the kind of environment that gets associated with sex and sexuality. Mm. So what you're really doing here to these 12 men is not just threatening them with electric shocks. You're potentially making it so they're going to need electric shocks. Look at what you've done, Baholo.
Which is expensive and niche. Look at what you've
done. Well... Yes. Shall I talk about some melons?
please do.
Okay, so what I desperately tried to do when I was preparing, to the point of probably compromising my search history, although anyone who listens to this is basically going to feel compromised, you know, whatever, to find a study that I'd once been told about, I think in my A-level psychology class, that was considered a nice bit of empirical evidence for some Freudian theorists. Basically, this study gave female participants a free choice of a variety of melons, which were, therefore, because of different melon breeds, of different sizes. They found a nice negative correlation between the size of the melons chosen and the bra size of the participants, which demonstrates the Freudian, or at least the psychodynamic principle of overcompensation. The more you're anxious about something, the more you defend against it. It was actually introduced by Adler, one of the early collaborators with Freud, and it was described as a standard response to feelings of inferiority. Now, if the study I've just succinctly described does exist somewhere, which is not on the internet, then this is what it shows. If we assume that there is a bra, or more specifically a breast size, that is considered optimal by women, and because my brain finds the system currently used a little too amathematical or multidimensional for my liking, let's assume that it's a D cup and not worry about the numbers, and the difference from it causes anxiety, then one is going to be more anxious in that area with an A cup than a C cup. Right. Yeah? Clear? Now.
Yep.
Good. Overcompensation.
Crystal.
I would want to know what size melons men would choose and what would define that. Anyway, an overcompensation tries to symbolically deal with this anxiety. And if the anxiety is greater, the symbol needs to be stronger. Hence, bigger melons are selected. They don't actually do anything. They're not somehow then being placed in these women's tops. You know, it's just picking out some melons, and they don't know. They haven't been primed with any particular anxiety about their curvaceousness. So, anyway, I couldn't find that original study. Maybe it's a myth. Maybe it's a thing that just dropped off the radar. I tried to search for it on a scholar website and tries various search terms. The only thing I found that was vaguely Freudian was from the Journal of Chemical Ecology that proves that even the search engine has Freudian tendencies. The title was, "Can Ménage à Trois be used for controlling insects?" Not incest, insects. Yeah.
I mean, if it does exist, it's great. And if anyone manages to find it, then please let us know, because it would be great. I have had similar situations to this in the past, which leads me to be slightly... Well, you'll see what I mean by similar situations in a sec. Slightly suspicious, where I can remember a study that I've been told about but can't find it anywhere. And then it subsequently turns out that the study doesn't exist, but was an example of a study used to like a made-up study used to illustrate a point. That one in particular was one, a hypothetical study in which... there was found a genetic basis for chopstick usage in a San Francisco sample of participants. And it was to do with like kind of conflating your phenotypes.
I feel that you're using that bell more and more irresponsibly.
The idea being that there are a lot of Asian there's a large Asian population in the area that the study hypothetically would have been done, and that they would, therefore you would get this kind of conflation of being Asian and being good at chopsticks. Anyway, I am concerned that this melon study might be like an exemplum rather than a real thing.
Exemplum, etc. Because of copyright, and if Tim Minchin catches me, he'll slap me around the face. Everybody! yeah,
I'm sure my boss is good about that sort of thing. So, yeah, but I really hope it does exist.
Yes. Well, I did manage to find a study about overcompensation that did exist, which does tie into some of the stuff we do know about overcompensations, i.e. big cars. Now, don't worry, it's not a size thing. What they were looking into, was gender compensation. And they did a variety of studies based on this similar principle, telling men or women that they were masculine or feminine using fake feedback, which I really hope we never receive, but how we know. We're being studied, perhaps, by the strange psychologists hiding on the internet. And seeing how threatened they were when their gender identity was being attacked and their testosterone levels. Now, they cited this research that Ben's already talked about on homophobia and suggest that reaction formation, which is what Freud called it, and overcompensation, which is a specific sort of it, have been more empirically supported than many Freudian ideas. So in the first part, they used three measures to check masculine overcompensation. They were supporting the Iraq War, desiring to own an SUV, and having homophobic attitudes.
Woo!
So,
go men.
Yeah, the men in the sample were randomly assigned to groups that received feedback that they were either more feminine or more masculine. And those in the feminine condition showed a much more masculine position on these political and automotive issues. Greater support for the war, greater desire to drive an SUV compared to a minivan, sedan or coupe. Those are all American terms. 4x4, people carrier, saloon maybe, and sports car, I'm guessing. I don't understand cars.
Free translation from American to English.
Hooray! To the point that they'd actually happily pay the specific sum of $7,320 more for an SUV than men who weren't threatened in their masculinity.
But not a dollar more.
Precisely. Women, on the other hand, were not threatened by suggesting to be masculine and didn't actually show any shift away from their, you know, kind of positions. There was no difference in the women. So, I guess there might be societal reasons for this. It's more acceptable for a woman to be masculine than for a man to be feminine, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps.
I don't quite know. They don't go really into it. Emotion-wise, threatened men reported feeling more guilty, ashamed, upset, and hostile, all of those significantly different than the unthreatened men. Women only showed one emotional difference, more masculine. Well, women who were told they were more masculine reported feeling higher levels of nervousness, but that was it. And in the follow-up, men who were threatened showed increased social dominance orientation, specifically, which is a specific thing about one's desire for a set hierarchy of groups ruling over other groups and to be potentially high up in that hierarchy. But they didn't show high conservatism or traditionalism in general. In fact, they were specifically macho, hawkish. They wanted to be brash and dynamic and strong. even though in both studies they showed liberalism, like all of the men were quite liberal in the pre-testing.
Huh. Well, there you go.
And indeed, these results were all replicated when a variable was whether they felt threatened as a gender, rather than putting on an artificial threat to them. Hmm. And they repeated the first study while measuring testosterone levels and found an interaction. Testosterone on its own, surprisingly perhaps, given we talk about testosterone-driven people, didn't predict the attitudes, you know, homophobia or desire to own an SUV, but they found an interaction. When there was high testosterone and you threatened someone's gender identity, they showed huge overcompensation. So, if you're, that's another psychomedia tip, if you're an SUV salesman, try and get someone's testosterone going. In fact, you could refer back to studies similar to what Ben talked about, the study of Hellhammer, greatest name of any researcher of all time. Hellhammer found that watching erotic stimuli leads to an increase in the level of testosterone, which you might argue didn't need to be proven, but you've got to make sure. And what he did with the stimulus materials afterwards, we'll never know. But it was the 80s, after all. Those VHSs were more difficult to find. Anyway, I don't know what to say.
You say that with a degree of irritation.
There was just more mystery to, you know, erotic stimuli back in the day. I'm saying, as a scientist, I think there should be more enigma in our work and our stimulus materials. Yeah.
When you're starting to talk about enigma, then it was really hard to get porn.
Yeah, I think the Nazis frowned on using like the hardcore like code making for sending like erotica. They're like, this isn't needed for important war transmissions. What are you doing? They didn't have that.
Yes, that was the original sext message.
We've talked about this before in the past. You know,
we have?
Yeah. Cybersex using the medium of semaphore.
Oh, right.
You know, when was this idea of sexting invented? Man, was it, was it semaphore? Flags. Was it telegraph? Were there kind of Morse code people going beep, 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 etc.? And that was
some bits. A semaphore flag in your pocket, or are you just pleased to see me?
Well, anyway, the point is...
Wait, is that two semaphore? What?
Oh, that's quite a complicated pattern, really. It's impressive that you're managing that in your pocket at all. Yeah, if you want to sell an SUV, show some erotic stimuli and then go, you're watching this, but also you're a girl. And then $7,320 more. And that is all I have to say on the matter.
I think that's all that anyone should really have to say on any of this stuff. Possibly too much.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe.
Good. We have said either exactly enough or too much.
Yeah, I would say there are some people who are going to say we have given too much information in this episode. And, well, don't blame us. Blame Freud.
Yes, it's all his fault, despite being only tentatively related to anything we've ever spoken about in this episode.
Yeah.
I think next week, because we've done, like, disgust and what has turned into an awful lot of penises, we should do something nice and inoffensive and dry next week. Maybe we should do the maths one next week.
Yeah, maybe that is what's going to happen. But of course, promising things for future episodes is just not something we do these days.
Exactly. Who knows what may happen.
Exactly.
So, thank you for listening. Hope you've enjoyed the episode. I certainly have.
Yes, it's been fun to do. Yeah. We'll see if it's been fun to listen to, but it's certainly been enjoyable to subject you to. Really, in the end, does anything else matter?
This is, after all, entirely for our benefit, not yours. However, if you do feel that you have benefited or are, you know, apoplectically angry at what we've said, please do contact us through the usual channels. You're going to have to do it. I can never remember.
At Team Psychomedia on Twitter, or at TetrarchAngel if you just want to talk to me, and psychomediapodcast@gmail.com. And you can leave a comment on the blog. Well, you know what I mean. The kind of show notes at psychomedia.wordpress.com.
Woo!
I think we just have to say goodbye.
Good.
And not anything else. Make sure that you get it right. No Freudian slips. Goodbye.
Good penis.
Doctor, when I press my finger here, it hurts, and here, it hurts, and here, and here. What do you think is wrong with me?
Well, you probably have a broken finger. Try putting this on and see if it helps.
Okay.
No, not round your finger.
Oh, but... Well, doctor, some days I feel like a teepee, and other days I feel like a wigwam.
Well, it could be that you're too tense. but I should double check using my penile plethysmograph.
Doctor, I think I'm invisible.
Well, I'd better get my invisible penile plethysmograph.
Well, Doctor, everyone keeps ignoring me.
Well, that's not really a medical complaint, is it? But if it helps, I can get my penile plethysmograph.
Doctor, I have an unexplained rash.
Ah, you've been overusing your penile plethysmograph. Psych! You can never overuse a penile plethysmograph.